weather today in the Grand.
I love you so badly, I could.
They're solid plastic, so don't settle for imitation.
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Good evening, this is Genevieve the Merchant, and this is the Best of an Alan Smithy podcast. You give us 63 minutes and we'll give you 63 minutes of words. Tonight's double feature episode is an inquiry into ichthyology and the rural tourist industry. From the 14th of August, 2010, it is a Roger Corman double feature. Joe Dante's 1978 cult classic, Piranha, and Scott P. Levy's 1995 television remake.
Hi everybody, welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew and I write at stopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for 1 hour. And this episode is a special all about Piranha in celebration of the upcoming Piranha 3D, which should be out shortly before or after you listen to this. We are talking about the original Joe Dante 1978 film and a little-known, obscure 1995 made-for-TV remake directed by Mr. Scott P. Levy, also called Piranha. And we'll call that one Piranha 95 to make the distinction. But first, we're going to talk about the good one, the original Piranha. And let's see. So I think we're both big Joe Dante fans, and this is the first of sort of a trilogy of movies that John Sayles wrote that were monster movies. The other two being Alligator in 1980, directed by Louis Teague, and The Howling, the famous werewolf movie in 81, also directed by Dante. But this was their first collaboration, and Sayles had been... Okay, so this was a New World production, and New World was the company that Roger Corman was heading in the late 70s. And a bunch of New World movies like Mutants and Galaxy of Terror and stuff have just been re-released on DVD. This one's been around for a while, and, you know, it's... It's really indicative of what Joe Dante's style is going to be for the rest of his career. It's a self-parody. It spoofs Jaws a bit, obviously. It's got cartoons in the background sometimes. It's got a bunch of actors that he's going to use, or at least a couple of actors that he's going to use repeatedly throughout his films, especially Dick Miller, who has a big role in this and who he always manages to squeeze into his movies in a cameo. But it's also got Kevin McCarthy, the star of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and someone that he would put into his later movies. But it's not so much a Joe Dante movie as it is like a, it's definitely a Joe Dante movie, but this is Joe Dante working for Roger Corman. And Joe Dante actually got his start editing trailers for Corman, basically for New World Pictures. And he co-directed with Alan Arkush a film called Hollywood Boulevard a couple of years before this, which I've never seen, but I've heard is really funny. And, And so there's a little bit of Corman in this movie as well. I mean, number one, the cash-in premise of the movie itself, you know, just kind of a lower budgeted version of Jaws, which just came out 3 years ago, and this came out the same year as Jaws 2. And as a side note, Universal almost sued New World Pictures for doing this movie, which is ridiculous. But then apparently Spielberg said, "No, it's good. Don't sue this. Don't sue this movie." one of the Roger Corman touches in this is Paul Bartel, who's a really funny actor and director of Corman movies. He directed Death Race 2000, which was a New World Picture. He's got a funny role in this as an obnoxious camp counselor. It's got, the cast, I guess it doesn't have a lot of cast members who Dante would use a lot, but, it does have, Belinda Bulaski as a camp counselor, and, Paul Bartel is the camp director, I should say, and Belinda Bulaski, who's one of the camp counselors, was the other female lead in The Howling, aside from Dee Wallace, and she dies in both of those movies. But it's got a lot of like tongue-in-cheek genre stuff, like just the casting of Barbara Steele, who is famous for starring in Mario Bava horror movies. Basically, this movie is indicative of Joe Dante's style to come, because it can get someone like me talking about all the trivia that's in it for people who know about B movies and enjoy playing spot the B movie actor and stuff. Oh, and the last little trivia bit I'll say in this introduction is that the piranha design and just a little tiny smidge of stop motion, but not of the piranhas, oddly enough, was done by Phil Tippett, who we've talked about before for doing the great effects in RoboCop, and he would also actually, I don't think he worked with Dante again, but oh, and Rob Bottin worked on this.
Yeah.
And Rob Bottin did Dante's effects in The Howling, all that great werewolf stuff. So. And I'll just say that I've seen this movie a few times before, but oddly enough, watching it again recently, I didn't enjoy it. I probably enjoyed it less than I have any time before, and I think the reason for that is that I recently rewatched Alligator, and it was a lot better than I remembered it, and I also rewatched The Howling, and it was a lot better. Like, it's already really good, but
right.
It was even better than I remembered it. And I think Piranha is kind of thinking of them as a trilogy because they're all written by John Sayles, Piranha is kind of the least of them, basically just for the reason that as monsters, and they are all monster movies, the Piranha don't have personality, really,
right.
The way that the big alligator does in Alligator or that the werewolves do in The Howling. The Piranha are kind of... the way my girlfriend put it was that they're kind of just a joke, and it would have been even more of a joke in 78 when, you know, Jaws ripoffs are popping up left and right, like, you know, freaking Orca from Dino De Laurentiis. I mean, Piranha, it's a bit like, oh yeah, haha, you know, it is played as a joke. I mean, probably the most famous line of the movie, which they put in the trailer, is when Dick Miller, who is this corrupt impresario who's opening up a resort in the lake that's infested by the piranha and doesn't want to close it down because he doesn't believe that there could be piranha in the waters. His assistant comes out to him and says, sir, it's the piranha. He goes, what about the goddamn piranha? He says, they're eating the guests, sir. And that's kind of the tone of the overall movie. It never takes itself too seriously. Even when the piranha are attacking people, the death of Kevin McCarthy is pretty vicious, and the guy who falls into the water,
and poor Belinda Bulaski's.
Oh yeah, all right. Well, let me just say, aside from when the piranha kill people, the mood is always fairly tongue in cheek and lighthearted.
Yeah, I mean, it opens. After the initial kill scene with the female lead, Heather Menzies, playing Jaws, the game.
Yeah, playing a Jaws arcade game. That's right.
Which has sort of the double emphasis, because isn't there a Jaws isn't there a shark arcade game in Jaws 2 at the beginning? Which wouldn't have been out yet.
I think it might have even been in Jaws 1, actually.
Yeah, so it's just kind of... I mean, they knew exactly what they were doing here, and...
And they know you know, especially in 78, that you're just going to see a Jaws knockoff.
And when I first saw this, because I think... I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast or if we talked about it in a pre-show right after the last time I saw it. I hadn't seen it in many years back when I saw all of sort of Sales's early screenwriting stuff. Back in the mid-90s, I saw all this stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so I saw this. I saw Alligator. I saw The Howling, I think, before I knew who John Sayles was or anything like that. And we talked about that a little bit. But so I always sort of approached it as, you know, a John Sayles movie back then. And so going back to it the last time, I really got to appreciate it because I hadn't seen it in so long. For Dante's stuff, I'd probably seen all of his stuff, but the problem with growing up with Dante is like, you know, yes, Gremlins 2 is great. You know, Gremlins I have lots of problems with, but I still saw it probably 15 times as a kid. Interspace, I mean, Interspace is great, but still, I saw Interspace, you know. Interspace was one of the first VHS tapes that, you know, was owned in my house. So, I mean, that thing got worn down just over the years. So it's like coming back to Dante after a little bit of a break and getting to appreciate him again, like sort of anew, is just really cool. And then I don't know what you did, but I watched Piranha 95 first.
I watched it second, actually.
Yeah, you probably should have. You should have done... I mean, I don't know what the we'll talk about what that is like, but for me, I was sitting there, like, I could tell you probably more about what John Sayles does as a screenwriter in Piranha than what he does as a screenwriter in, you know, Lodestar at this point, uh-huh. just because it's so clear.
I felt the same educational effect even watching Piranha 95 after the original.
But, you know, what's cool about Piranha is, yes, it's a spoof, but the characters are all engaging. And then I guess there's some line about Bradford Dillman, who plays the lead, complaining to John Sayles about what a crappy character he has. And apparently,
saying,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, Corman usually has us write the scripts pretty simply because most of these actors can't act, but I'll add some extra stuff for you. And actually, I think he did this. I think there's a similar story with Robert Forster in Alligator, where Robert Forster came up with the idea of complaining about his receding hairline, and Sayles was like, "Great, use it. Let me write some lines for you."
Well, this has a great Sayles cameo. Sayles, I mean, I think Sayles has been in movies that he isn't actually directing at some point. He played the villain in something that I've seen recently. Mm. But he's in this as the... It's 78, and for some reason this humor just struck me as something that they wouldn't do on a TV show today, that the two leads, Bradford Dillman and Heather Menzies, are... The Army's got them captured, or they're holding them until after the corrupt colonel.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, Bradford Dillman tells her to go out and distract the guard, you know, flash him. And she's like, well, wait a second, what if he's gay? And he's like, well, then I'll do it. But then they continue the scene where he goes out and it's Sayles playing the MP. And she's like, are you gay? And he's like, what?
Yeah.
And it just, I mean, there's just something about that that it's like, can you imagine that happening with, I don't know. I mean, I can't even see Kevin Smith doing something that funny. That one scene is funnier than anything in, you know, Kevin Smith movie ever in some ways.
Probably, yeah. I think Sayles has a real knack, especially, and I'm looking forward to watching some of the, like, crappy science fiction movies that he wrote or co-wrote for New World, because he has sort of a knack for taking movie cliches and then coming up with funny dialogue for them so that they feel like their familiarity becomes something good instead of something tiresome. like that scene, and also when they're in the local jail, and they have to get out, and they come up with the idea of how they're going to distract the guard and whack him over the head, and they're talking about it, and Heather Menzies is saying, like, you know, yeah, you know, I learned this trick from this guy that, that my office arrested, because she's with the Missing Persons Bureau, and it's just, yeah, that's really one of Sales' talents. So I'm, you know, like, there's some kind of cliched situations in Piranha, but, I mean, especially with Dante, it helps that Dante has such a love for, I think he's referred to this as, like, his, you know, 1950s monster movie, style movie. Like, instead of just copying Jaws and doing it with Piranha, he sort of did, you know, he sort of handles it like, I don't know, Them or something.
Yeah, but, that's really interesting.
With the exception of the plot about, you know, the local impresario not wanting to close down the resort so that you can have a lot of beachgoers getting massacred at some point. That's pretty much from Jaws.
Yeah, but the whole the army developed this to drop them in Vietnam, and then
oh right, yeah,
that whole thing, it just feels like a
movie stuff.
But
yeah,
it's updated and not stupidly, I guess would be the way to say it. That I mean, that's what I love
right
about Piranha.
They bred Piranha that could survive in all kinds of waters, so that they could release them into Vietnamese waters.
Because I mean, it's kind of like there are two ways to do this. One is like Mars Attacks, where you sort of luxuriate in the absurdity of everything you can possibly do.
Yeah.
And then the other way is this, where it's absurd. Everybody knows, and I mean, Dante's, the editing, it's so quick. I mean, I think it's a half hour in before they even, or it's at least 20 minutes in before they get on the river, and then that's a section of the movie where they're on the river trying to get to the dam, and then you sort of go into the last day of the movie. But it's not taken seriously, but it's not at all a condescending humor. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, Sales helps with that. But, I mean, the cast is just, I think that's what, you know, impressed me the last time I watched it was, you know, they get so much mileage out of this cast that, I mean, the camp counselors, can you imagine if either of the girls who played the camp counselors were in any of the Friday the 13th movies? I mean, they'd all of a sudden be good. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, Dante just gets, so it's just this weird mix of, you know, a spoof, but not really a spoof. It's kind of like a, you know, the spoof aspect of Piranha breaks the, what is it, the fourth wall, where there's an agreement between the viewer and the filmmakers that, yes, it's a Jaws spoof, but no, the movie itself isn't a Jaws spoof, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, the concept is a spoof, but, or actually, not really the concept, it's like the reason for the movie existing is a spoof, but that doesn't mean that, you know, they're just going to do a Mad Magazine treatment of the script to Jaws. It's quite delightful, and you know, Dante basically abandoned being a serious, or not so serious as it were, horror movie director with The Howling, and you know, like you've said on the stop button, The Howling is his straightest movie, and this Piranha is just a little bit less straight than The Howling. Like, it's not trying to be scary. It tries to be. It definitely tries to generate suspense around the piranha, but is kind of what I was saying about the piranha not having personality. You can think of them as a threat, but they're not what I would call scary unless you're ichthyophobic or whatever. I think the only time they're really scary is when Bradford Dillman is underwater at the climax of the movie, and he's releasing the pollution into the water to kill the piranha, and the piranha all gang up on him, and they're just, like, chomping him to bits, and it doesn't seem like he's going to survive. And that's probably when the piranha are the most scary. The rest of the time, it's like, you know, well, they move so fast, and
the editing is so fast that it's like,
You never get to look at them for more than a second, and I guess they were afraid that, like, the piranha puppets, because, like, when the piranha attack people, all it is like they're wiggling piranha puppets onto people and under cranking the film and playing this this dentist drill sound effect to further noise. And, you know, I've watched behind-the-scenes footage of this movie, and those piranha puppets didn't really look so bad on their own, actually. They should have featured them a little bit more. I love when Dillman and Menzies are in Kevin McCarthy's laboratory, and just for a second you see one of the piranha like in a mason jar, and it looks mean. Rob Bottin sculpted the piranha so that they would always be scowling and that they had these big white eyes, and they're quite mean looking, which is great. They have great design. It's just too bad that like you're not gonna. You don't get to look at that unless you pause your movie when they're chomping on people. You know what? Oh, and one more thing about the 50s science fiction movie effect. That wouldn't work nearly as well as it does if they didn't have Kevin McCarthy as the scientist who created the piranha, because he gets to have, before he gets killed about, you know, 30 minutes or 40 minutes in, he gets to have the great exposition about why the piranha were bred to be super killer fish, and he's just so, you know, he's talking about raising killer fish, but he's dead serious, and Kevin McCarthy is a veteran at that kind of stuff, so he's great. I mean, he even elevated Ghoulies 3, Ghoulies Go to College, which is to say he can elevate pretty much anything.
One of the things that we cannot not talk about is the Pino... Donaggio score.
Yeah, Donaggio. Pino Donaggio is like a really great movie composer, and he never gets his due. But he did the music for Carrie, and like that's one of the main things that makes that movie so frightening is how scary the music is. And then he did this, and then he came back to Dante and Sales again, and did the music for The Howling, and the music to The Howling is fantastic. And it's really good here, and it's not really like. It's really melodic and kind of understated. There's no real themes except really for the piranha's theme, which starts to play when they approach, and it's very like twinkly and plucking on violins, and it's cool. Yeah, the music's excellent.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy just glancing at his really long filmography. It's like he started with Western, by Western, I guess I mean West of Italy directors, and then ended up back in Italy in the mid-80s, coming back some. But, I mean, you know, he did the score for Blowout, which was always... It's just amazing. And that's the music that Tarantino rips off for the really good sequence in... Is it Grindhouse?
Death Proof.
The yeah. one really beautifully scored sequence in that. That's the music from Blowout. And that's this guy doing stuff. And, I mean, he does a lot of different stuff in this because there's no romance between Bradford Dillman and Heather Menzies that's described in any way. I mean, I don't even know if she touches his shoulder in some, you know, affectionate way. But with the score, it implies it, and it makes their sort of trip together, you know, very... I mean, I almost wonder if it's supposed to be kind of an inverse of the Clark Gable, Claudette Colbert. It Happened One Night, in some ways. Like, you know, that was throwing these two people together and having them do this. It's just an aspect of the script, but it really creates this odd situation, and it plays with the, you know, traditional thing, the traditional kind of romantic comedy in the sort of, because if you think about 50s movies, there's, you know, the smart guy who saves the day usually has the girl. Trying to think if Dante did that, and Dante does that in Small Soldiers eventually, which I would say is on the surface owes a little bit more to that, the 50s stuff. God, I can't believe I'm saying that. Small Soldiers is so bad. But, I mean, it does, because the teenage kid knows everything, and he gets the girl at the end, and so, I mean, that reminds me more of It Came from Outer Space than something in this, or any of those movies with Richard Carlson, you know, the Deadly Mantis, it's always the scientist eventually who is the guy. But what's so interesting, and remind me how I want to segue on Corman. I'll save him for the very end. But John Davison produced this.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, later producer of RoboCop and Starship Troopers and some other big movies that I can't remember.
And but, then the editing was from Mark Goldblatt.
Oh, yeah, who'd go on to The Terminator and some big movies.
And Halloween 2, let's not forget that, for the Alan Smithy tie-in. And
yeah.
Oh, wow, he also edited Showgirls.
Wow, but, this movie's really a catalog of talent.
It kind of like The Howling in some ways. That I mean, this is still that period. I find it hard to believe that the guys who make, what's an example of some spoofy comedy these days?
From the Scary Movie,
right? There you
movies.
Go. The guys who do the technical, the crew on Scary Movie 4. Are not going to go on to 20-year careers of defining artistic blockbusters. I mean, like...
Yeah.
That isn't rewarding
anymore. You know, it's the one... If you can only say one good thing about Roger Corman, he knows how to pick talent when they're inexperienced and cheap, but he knows how to spot talent who do in fact go on to greater things, and he's done that pretty much his whole career. So, what else is there to say about the original Piranha?
The whole idea of the resort, and I had said I thought the resort took place in Michigan, just because, I mean, you're from Michigan. I had a friend who lived there, so I spent a lot of summers in Michigan. The whole idea of having a resort that is not on the ocean is sort of, you know, in the film, in the cinematic sense, absurd. I mean, because, you know, Speed 2 does not take place on them going through a cruise up the Mississippi or something. Mm-hmm. It'd be really funny if it did, but... Yeah, and it's kind of weird because, I mean, Piranha... If I didn't know that resorts existed, you know, lake and river resorts existed, Piranha would probably convince me that they could in some ways. They just do a really good job of making Dick Miller seem like this really... I mean, his scenes actually remind me of Bugsy with Warren Beatty, that one scene where he's yelling at everybody. Every time I see it now, I just think of Bugsy, where they're putting the hotel together. I mean, just sort of this scaled-down megalomania amusement park. And there's this great scene where his Dick Miller's sidekick comes up to him and is like, hey, so I heard somebody noticed that was from, you know, some other regional amusement park, and this was from some other regional amusement park, and... Dick Miller just, you know, wow. I think if you saw this in 78, Dick Miller would be the one you were talking about when you left the theater.
Right.
Because, I mean, he's just so, so good in it.
Yeah.
Anything?
Well, let's see. Keenan Wynn's in this. I hadn't noticed.
Yeah, he's the old man. There's a guy named Gooch in it.
Do you think that any of the kids died during the Piranha's attack on the summer camp?
Yeah.
I think it's strongly implied. I was just looking for, like, you know, dead kids' bodies or something blatant or anything. Because, like, they're definitely getting attacked, but...
There's that... When they come up on the... And I did find one other trivia point for us to mention that is neither of us are going to know anything about. When Bradford Dillman gets there, and sees Paul Bartel. Paul Bartel is in front of somebody that's covered up. And I assume that's a kid and not the girl.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
the girl, they would never have gotten back.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering about that. On the other hand, there have to be more than two counselors. I mean, I think it's implied for sure. Yeah. It's which makes it pretty gutsy. I mean, I always have a soft spot in my heart for movies that kill children or dogs.
Yeah.
And this movie almost kills a dog.
It does.
Almost.
The dog just disappears, though. I felt really bad.
Piranha 95 kills a dog.
The boy dog with the girl's name. Because the dog's name, I think, is Brandy. Oh, it's after Brandy. Oh, duh. I missed the drinking joke. but, yeah, I mean, this movie's treatment of alcoholism as a disease is somewhat revolutionary. It's encouraged. I mean,
yeah.
It's... The great American dream is living on the river and drinking and doing nothing else.
Yeah, it really is.
But, oh yeah, the last trivia point. The Hertz clerk at the beginning is an uncredited cameo of Amy Holden Jones, whose name
of the Slumber Party Massacre.
Yeah. And I guess before this, she was assistant to the director on Taxi Driver. So even though Joe Dante wasn't really in the upper tier of the that generation, the Scorsese, Coppola.
Yeah.
He was definitely immediately on the periphery of it. I mean, because, you know...
Right. It's just that those guys look down their noses on Roger Corman Productions as well.
And then, you know, I mean, Spielberg did sort of adopt Joe Dante in some ways. For at least Gremlins, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, maybe we should mention that... is it almost about time to get to Piranha 95?
Yeah.
Okay, because speaking of Spielberg, after this movie, Dante actually got an offer to direct the second Jaws sequel, and Universal's idea was to make it an all-out spoof and have it called Jaws 3 People Zero, and you can actually read about this in the book The Greatest Films Never Made by Chris Gore. Editor of Film Threat, but he, you know, didn't end up doing it, and ended up doing The Howling instead. But that would have been, I guess, his first association, at least peripherally, with Spielberg. And
are we segueing?
I think so.
Okay, so my segue suggestion is Corman.
Right. So speaking of Corman,
in the 90s, Corman turned a bunch of his old movies into
made-for-TV remakes.
Showtime remakes, and we all know how well we did with Showtime last episode, and I think we're not watching TV movies for a while. I don't care what network they aired on. And I was thinking about it. I was staring, you know, in horror at the screen during the Piranha remake because, I mean, the thing opens and the font for the opening titles is a really crappy video editing font that I think, you know, we had at my high school on the you know, half-inch video editor. Mm-hmm. It looks that cheap. That he never remade The Intruder, his movie with Shatner about...
Yeah, well, that one lost him a ton of money the first time, so I don't know why he would want to.
Well, it's also it's also one of his only movies that is sort of critically respected as a director. But anyway, so Piranha the remake, all I could think during this heinous 89 minutes or whatever it was, you know, it probably cost more than the original did.
You think so?
I think it probably did. The original was low. I mean, it's like, there's the difference. Low-budget filmmaking used to encourage inventiveness. And now, since sort of the direct-to-DVD, direct-to-video phenomenon, TV movie phenomenon, it just encourages crap. It's not inventive anymore. Nobody's trying to figure out how to do stuff with less. They just freaking do something terrible.
Yeah, although this movie was pre-CG, so you can't accuse it of having bad CG effects. The bad effects it does have are a combination of wholesale recycling footage of the piranhas chewing on people from the first movie, and even a couple of shots from the movie itself, like the very last shot of the ocean from the original is the last shot of this one too. But they combine that with some new piranha puppets that are like three times as big as the original Phil Tippett ones, or Rob Bottin ones, I guess. And I think these ones were done by John Carl Buechler. I saw his name in the credits, and he's a B-movie director of some note. But anyways, oh, and effects designer of some note. But anyways, yeah, they're horribly mismatched. They're like three times as big, and instead of being kind of bluish gray, they're like solid black. Anyways, which is why I would be surprised if this cost more, but, you know, it doesn't really have any... It's got four... Well, it stars William Catt in the Bradford Dillman role, and he's, you know, the best actor in the movie, so he's got that going for him, but...
yeah, and I like William Catt, like, because I grew up on the Perry Mason TV movies, but after this, I was just mortified. I was just like, really?
Well, it's horrible casting, because, I mean... Could he at least have grown a beard like Bradford Dillman had? Because William Catt looks about as likely to live in the woods.
He's got a totally different story, though. I mean, that's what's so funny about it is that it's he's a city guy who got fed up with the environment getting screwed up, so he moved out to the woods to write a book. I'm pretty sure he's not a total lush drunk. and I mean, right. In the first one, the guy's just he's a laid-off... you know, smelt plant worker. And yeah. So for some reason they felt the need to,
yeah, I mean, they kept the ex-wives and the kid at the summer camp to run to. But you know, they kept a lot of things because this movie is, based on, they just like took Sales's screenplay out of some file drawer and gave it to a guy named Alex Simon, who added all these crappy lines and like did idiotic updates to details in it, like, oh, the piranha weren't bred for Vietnam, they were bred for Cold War stuff.
Well, they take out the entire military thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they do.
And I can't believe, and they basically fill it with a topless sequence involving Leland Orser playing a commercial director.
Yeah.
And so basically he's hitting on some camp counselor. And that's the other thing is, in the original, both camp counselors were sympathetic, and this one of them is evil, and they get rid of Paul Bartel. And the nice one is played by Punky Brewster, and wow, is she freaking awful, and I was so glad when she got it. But, I mean, it's like, if you look at the cast, so you got William Catt, okay...
Yeah,
you probably would have known him from TV if you saw this, but maybe not. He's recognizable, though, to some degree, right? Yeah. Alexandra Paul from... And I just watched Dragnet, and my wife was just like, I hate that woman so... I love Dragnet, but I hate that woman so much. And I'm like, right, but I think that's the point. I think she's supposed to be really obnoxious, but still somehow sympathetic, because, like, you know... Those kind of people would be really obnoxious. So you have her in this role that's supposed to be the... Well, this comic role, and she's just terrible in this. I mean, just in the first one, it's a joke that it's unbelievable this woman is a private investigator, you know, and so it's funny. And this one, it's just painful. And I mean, some of that's the direction, some of it, whoever the guy who directed this, who was a boom operator on the Corman Fantastic Four, also, I just noticed, they suck all the humor out of Piranha. I mean, they play it straight, which is just freaking absurd.
They even like play straight the funny lines that they stole from the original. Like they take that you know, what about the goddamn piranha? They're eating the guests, sir, line, and they play it straight. The guy's like, they're eating the guests, and it's mortifying. And then sometimes they do try to play a funny line like it's supposed to be funny. And it's just not, like, you know, Alexandra Paul asks for a sip of William Catt's flask, and he says the same line that Bradford Dillman has in the original, which is like, okay, but it's not water, you know, and she drinks it, spits it, you know, it's alcohol. But somehow in this version, it's just not funny. The timing is just not there, and Scott P. Levy didn't want to do another take of that.
Okay, when I say that it must have cost more, I just mean by inflation, because I'm thinking about the really crappy sets now. Okay.
Oh my God! Do you remember when, like, they're supposed to have walked into the room of the lab, you know, the laboratory room, which was Kevin McCarthy's in the original, and they can't even like show the door opening because that'll reveal the set. Like they just, they're just in there all of a sudden, like they teleported.
Yeah, I mean that whole sequence. It's just, and then they combine characters like the
Dick Miller. Character gets combined with the guy who sends Alexandra Paul out on her missing persons case.
And it's played by Monty Markham, who is always famous to me as being the abusive from Melrose Place. He abused poor Courtney Thorne Smith, which was always traumatizing to me because she was the nice girl from summer school.
Hmm. Yeah. And Revenge of the Nerds, too.
Oh, I don't. See, well, there you go. That's the difference. I didn't get done with the absurd casting. Leland Orser's in it. But no, freaking Mila Kunis is in this.
Yeah.
And like, you know, and Mila Kunis of the Book of Eli, the Book of Eli 2, you know, Mila Kunis on the road.
The Road Warrior. Yeah. And, well, that 70s show, obviously. And, you know, she's a good child actor, for sure. It's just really weird to see her in this, because I haven't seen her child roles and except for this, and she looks, you know, it's the same person for sure.
I
don't know what to say about that.
They change Kevin McCarthy to a woman, which is
they change her to an awful woman who can't act.
But so basically, they took and the old man in this. I don't even know who plays him. Like, it's nobody. And it's like, so, I mean, it's a TV movie. They could have gotten somebody. Somebody was hungry. You know, freaking, you know, Dudley Morse basically, you know, died destitute. They could have paid him scale to play the old man in this. Like, somebody like that. Like,
which old man are you talking about?
That gets his legs chewed off at the beginning.
Oh right.
Yeah,
right.
Down the River guy. Frank. I don't know what his name is in this. Oh, and they ethnicized the cast, which I thought was awesome.
Oh, yeah, they turned the father and son who get killed just before the scientist who saves the little boy. They made him black. Oh, and they have really really ethnic dialogue before they get killed.
And they have more dialogue actually than in the original.
Right.
And so that's what's kind of funny is they suck all of the sales out of the dialogue.
They take the wind out of it.
And then
as it were.
Instead they inflate it with. You know, just this crap. I mean, like I said before, I watched it first.
Yeah.
And so when going back to it, I'm like, why the hell wouldn't they keep that line about the, you know, the line in the first one about the camp counselor implying that they could just tell the camp director that, you know, Susie Grogan had her period. Shit, man, that's a better line than, you know, you could find in, I don't know, it's a more honest human line than you'll find in, what, Pulp Fiction? Like, and so when the guy was sitting there with his red marker, he crossed that out from this script. He was like, I don't want to use that. Like,
yeah. I watched this second after the original, and I knew I was in trouble in the first scene where the couple who, you know, mistakenly decide to take a dip in the pool where Kevin McCarthy is growing the piranha. You know, they're sneaking through the gate and stuff, and I, you know, like, the shot, like, even the shot of the pan down of the do not trespass sign on the gate is, like, swiped from the original. But they're getting ready to go into the pool, and the girl is like, you know, gee, I want, you know, because her boyfriend's a wimp, she's like, gee, I wanted Indiana Jones for a boyfriend, and, who, you know, I get Woody Allen instead. And I'm just like, oh, my God.
Because that's good for your target audience, because Woody Allen has always been very popular with your target audience for a Piranha TV movie. The last time he would have been popular, Piranha would have been coming out. I say being an appropriate reference for that. Because presumably the target audience for this,
like when the,
is...
when the Woody Allen comic strip wasn't still in newspapers.
I mean, this is like...
Indiana Jones isn't even a good reference in 95, as you pointed out. It's been 6 years since the last one.
So it's kind of like, wow. Maybe Corman had been planning these remakes for a while, but... And then, of course, the extended nude scene with the playmate or whoever the hell she was. I mean, it's just like...
Yeah, this movie's got way more tits than the original did.
And... But it's like, if you're watching it on Showtime, wouldn't you just wait until 11 o'clock or turn it to Cinemax? I mean, why the hell?
Yeah, wait until Hot Springs Hotel is on, or Compromising Situations.
Just anything but this. I mean, it's not worth sitting through this for the...
Yes, it's so not worth it.
And then there's not even a...
You know what else was real disappointing cast-wise? I got excited when I saw that James Caan was in this. And, you know, of Return of the Living Dead fame and many, many films. And he has, like, literally two scenes with like, five lines each. He gets to do the closing line of the movie, but that's his only other scene is like when he shows up, and I was hoping he would be, you know, the surrogate Dick Miller part, basically. But they completely wasted having James Caan around.
And it makes you wonder if, you know, it's like, what if you take everything out of a movie and remake it? And it's just kind of an incredible idea. I mean, it's so reductionist.
It's educational, you know, probably from any kind of filmmaking angle that you want to approach this from. It's fascinating because it really is like a carbon copy of Piranha, but they screw up everything.
Like I had said that we should, it's too bad we can't do some sort of a video, where we run through them side by side.
Because
I mean, it's just insane. Because I imagine that a lot of the other Corman remakes of this era are probably like this. It's just that I've never seen. I have no interest in seeing the original Wasp Woman, so I haven't seen the second one.
The original Not of This Earth is pretty good. I don't know about the remake with Tracy Lords though.
That was theatrical though. That's not from this stupid Showtime deal. I think so. I mean, at least it was intended to be. It was as theatrical as Millennium and Return of Swamp Thing were.
They didn't do Humanoids from the Deep.
Didn't they? I thought they did.
Oh, no. Yeah, they did. I wonder if they reused the shots of the humanoids.
That would be another interesting one to do, because Humanoids from the Deep is always, you know, an incredibly... I always think of it as just a very gross movie.
I still haven't seen it, actually.
Oh, yeah, it's...
But that's one of the ones that's just been re-released on DVD, because it was a New World picture.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just... And so Corman, at some point, went from being somebody who encouraged... sort of inventiveness to just being somebody who encouraged crap. Yes, yeah, they do recycle footage from it in the remake. Yeah.
By the way, you mentioned Leland Orser earlier.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, because this is the movie that taught me that guy's name, I had always thought of him as the guy in Alien Resurrection who has a chest burster come out of him, and Sigourney Weaver tells him that he's going to die.
See,
so now I know this guy's name. And he's always he's the guy who John Doe forced to wear a knife dildo or a knife strap on in Seven.
Yeah, and he's always screaming and crying.
Yeah,
and that's what I always knew him as. And I think he actually finally did something where he doesn't do that. You got to look, because I actually talked smack about him in Alien Resurrection, and people were like, no, I thought he was good, and oh, he was actually in Escape from LA. See, we don't even remember that. Well, that's actually a pretty big jump. He was in Piranha 1 year, and by two years later, he had gotten into real theatrical movies.
It's just one year later. Escape from LA was 96. This is 95.
No, yeah, I mean, he... He wasn't just, I just saw him in Give Him Hell Malone. He's actually, I think, in that to some degree, and he's fine. And he was in Taken, and he was, I mean, so it's just like, and he's better in this than I'd say he is in Alien 4 or 7. I mean, he's just playing a sleazebag film. Yeah. He's actually playing somebody that you could see John Sayles writing now.
Yeah.
Like,
because
he's this guy who tries to use his lame-ass job to score with this slutty chick, and it doesn't work out for him.
And then
she gets eaten. Yeah.
Well, actually, he doesn't get eaten.
She does, though.
Right, right. But then he just disappears. And then at the end of the movie, they're like, "Oh yeah, we found Leland Orser sucking his thumb in a rowboat," and he's all traumatized, and he's doing his Leland Orser thing. He also does his Leland Orser thing when he watches her get eaten.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I'm sure they cast. I think he was in Independence Day. I wonder if he was doing a Leland Orser thing in that too. But he's gotten away from that, which is good. And did you notice that? As I was trying to amuse myself with something during this movie, it really looked like a William Caddett had a facelift.
Nope, I didn't notice
okay.
that.
Okay, you were more engaged than I was.
Yeah, I was.
I was like, what happened to his eyes? He's got the Robert Redford thing going with his eyes. Did William Caddy have work? Because this is like the worst role to have that done. And honestly, if you were to remake the Sayles script of Piranha, you could make it pretty quickly into something that people should be clamoring to be in. Like the Paul Grogan, whatever it is, the role itself should give you a lot of opportunity, because I mean, it's like you go from being a drunken, you know, antisocial guy to
you have this chemistry with your female lead. You've got your kid that you're concerned about. It's a great role.
Yeah, you save the day a little. I mean, you know, you got struggle, everything. This is the kind of thing that Michael Keaton would have just done great right after Jack Frost too. But
was there a Jack Frost 2?
No. I'm referring to your post about Jack Frost 2 where...
Oh, okay, yeah.
I was...
It'd be funny if there were two Jack Frost 2s, but there's only two Jack Frosts.
That's true. And Jack Frost ruined Michael Keaton's career.
You the man. No, you the snowman.
You know, I still haven't seen it. Isn't that from the maker of Daredevil?
I don't know. I'm not planning on seeing it.
But,
Yeah.
Yeah, so this and the music. Okay, so, you know, about 30 minutes ago, we talked about the great music in Piranha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Presumably,
I don't even remember. I don't even remember the music in Piranha 95.
It's really terrible. And it's the entire time I was watching Piranha.
All I remember is the thrash metal song Killer Mutant Fish that played over the credits.
Oh, wow. See, I totally did not watch that part. But, They get rid of the score and they replace it with some crappy TV, not even, you know, quality TV score. I mean, what's that guy's name who does all the TV shows? W.G. Snuffy Walden did not do the music for this. It's just some, you know, hacky McHacky did it. And all I could think when I was watching the original Piranha was, you know, I bet if they just recycled the music, it would have made the other one so much more watchable. It would have felt classier. It would have felt like they weren't filming on infomercial sets or something. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, in this one, and again, I say that I think it costs more because of inflation. The scene where Alexandra Paul gets the job is totally different now. In the original, there is this sort of screenwriting efficiency that introduces backstory for a character, establishes all sorts of stuff, and moves her along. They don't do that here. Here, they have the scene where she comes in and is hired by Monty Markham to go find his niece. Yeah. And that's the other interesting thing.
Have to tell you what an important client this guy is.
Yeah. And it's filmed on an infomercial set. It's filmed on one of those, like... You know, if you've ever had a job where they had an HR video, it's filmed on that HR video set. I mean, it's just, it's terrible. And it's just kind of like, Corman clearly stopped giving a crap about this stuff.
Yeah, sometime around Frankenstein Unbound.
That must just be it, is that he...
It broke his will.
Well, because, you know, he sold his library to Miramax at some point, like his, or did Disney straight at some point. So, I mean, it, at some point it became clear that he could just do it, not have to actually produce anything new or good or anything and still do stuff. I mean, what was that one? I'm trying to think.
Was it a remake of his?
No, it was Fantastic Four, remember? He turned that into a payday, and then the movie never even came out.
Right.
I mean, you know, he got very thoughtful with how he was doing this stuff. Now, they did remake... I'm trying to think here. The remakes of... and I didn't even know... I'm just looking through his filmography really quick. They remade... Macon County, not Macon County Jail, whatever, it was, but Jackson County Jail, they remade that, which would have to be different than Piranha, just because the original was so different, but that's like the cool thing about the New World Picture line. I remember when they first came out on DVD, I didn't see Piranha in there, but I saw stuff like... Jackson County Jail, and I'm trying to find something else that I would have seen.
Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah, that sort of stuff. I mean, you would find these cool things, you know, and stuff you'd heard about, or I think I saw Jackson County Jail on Saturday afternoon on TV once, and later I was able to watch the whole thing because of this, and, you know, even Humanoids from the Deep and all that sort of thing, and then what the hell did he do later? I mean, this is what he did. Yeah. But even through the 80s, it seems like he hadn't given up yet, but
no,
if he didn't.
But I think Charles Band kind of supplanted his role in the 80s as the purveyor of B-movie garbage, but or fun garbage, at least. But yeah, Piranha 95, well, you know, it's going to, you know. Piranha 3D ain't going to be a direct remake the way this was a direct remake, no sir.
And I think when we talked about seeing this, I was under the IMDb credits are really crappy for it, because it says story by Richard Robinson, screenplay by John Sayles, story by John Sayles, Alex Simon, writer. Well, what it really is, Alex Simon, it's a screenplay by Alex Simon based on a screenplay by John Sayles and based on a story by Richard Robinson and John Sayles. So John Sayles had nothing to do with the script for this freaking movie in the sense that, you know, he had, it's not like David Webb Peebles sold the script for Soldier and they dug that shit out.
Yeah, this
nine
is more,
years after he sold it.
This is more like how Caligula is based on a screenplay by Gore Vidal.
Yeah, so I mean, it's just kind of like, when we went into this, I was like, well, at least the screenplay is going to be the same, right? Like, that's what it says.
Yeah, half of it, maybe. A quarter of it. the plot points, anyways. Most
but not
of
all of them, because they get rid of the army thing in a really stupid turn of events. I mean, that was just really stupid how they got rid of the army.
Oh, yeah, like they have the sheriff of the county as the kind of authoritarian bad guy instead of the army people. And it doesn't really make sense because it's like, why does the sheriff care about covering this up?
Yeah, they don't. I don't even think they have they take the time to make him an investor.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is, you know, Chaco Van Leeuwen produced this, and he was an executive producer on the first one, and that's actually his name. It's a nickname because the guy's Japanese, but I saw that and I was like, Chaco Van Leeuwen, it sounds like, you know, what's his face, that's the real name of the guy in Aliens. It would be hilarious if James Cameron named Van Leeuwen in Aliens after this guy.
You mean Weyland Yutani?
No, in Aliens, the guy Sigourney Weaver yells at, is his name's Van Leeuwen.
Oh.
I wonder if... I mean, Cameron worked for Corman. He would have worked with this guy. I wonder if that's... See, these are the James Cameron stories I want to hear and never will.
have you read that book, The Futurist? It just came out?
No,
okay, it's a recent Cameron biography. I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to. It should have a lot of interesting information about the Corman days and Piranha 2 and all that.
And we watched Piranha 2 for the podcast, so everyone can go back and listen to us bitch and moan about that. And, you know, Corman didn't actually have anything to do with it.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
But it is better than Piranha 95 in its own stupid way.
Yeah, because, I mean, Piranha 95 doesn't even have the interesting, creepy relationship between the mother and son.
Or original effects involving flying piranha.
Yeah, or, it had original effects. There you go. There's a...
Yeah.
There's a...
It had a piranha chest burster.
But what I did love is that I had forgotten, I guess, that
yeah.
Piranha 2 rips off the ending of Piranha 1. Just switches the plot point of the rope being...
There being, oh, yeah.
Yeah. There being some drama about that. It'll be interesting to see if Piranha 3D does that since
what
it
if,
is
what
a
if
staple.
Anything they, what, if anything, they borrow over? It all depends on how much of fans the writers were of the original, I guess. But, hey, you know, speaking of which, I am really looking forward to Piranha 3D. And I'm not getting paid to say that, unfortunately, but I am, because I love gimmicky 3D horror movies, and... I love Piranha, and it's got a great cast. It's you know what? This Piranha remake has a good, eclectic, character actor cast.
Yeah.
The way that the original Piranha did, oddly enough.
That's kind of the thing.
It's got Elizabeth Shue and Ving Rhames, Christopher Lloyd, and Richard Dreyfuss does a cameo, and Eli Roth does a cameo, and he's not a good actor, but he'll get killed, so...
That's what sold me on it, because I haven't seen any of Aja's other stuff. When I saw the cast, I was just like, this is going to be... I mean, it's, you know, Christopher Lloyd, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we've talked about the unfortunate disappearance of Christopher Lloyd, et cetera, but, you know, that's perfect.
He's the guy you want in the Kevin McCarthy role.
And then you've got Elizabeth Shue coming back. I mean, I know Elizabeth Shue has been in movies since The Saint, but I haven't seen any of them, so I don't care.
In Piranha, Shue's the sheriff.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, the Hollow Man. She was in Hollow. I forgot about that one. Anyway,
Shue's the sheriff. Yes.
Yeah. So, I can't wait.
There. What? So, she's the sheriff.
What?
I guess I didn't say that right. I was trying to make a little joke. You know that show with Suzanne Somers? She's the sheriff.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Well, does that about do it?
I think so.
So, yeah. Piranha. We've talked about all three Piranha movies up until this point, but pretty soon there's going to be a fourth movie. In the Piranha school of films. So we'll see how that is. But now we're both completely prepared to judge Piranha 3D on the merits of
Piranha 95.
Piranha 95 and Piranha 2, The Spawning, and the original. So if you haven't seen the original, go check it out. It's good.
And so next time...
Yeah, next week we're doing a South Korean comedy called Conduct Zero, or Zero in Conduct, and it's kind of a high school comedy. And that's a good movie. Our bad movie will be, what was it? Oh, yes, Uwe Boll's Far Cry. We're going back to the Uwe Boll well. We did Blood Rain 2 previously, and now we're going to do another one of his video game adaptations.
Which I believe is a straight action movie. So it'll be interesting to see what he does with...
An action movie without zombies or
vampires.
Yeah.
Or Romanian hookers.
Yeah.
Presumably.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it. So, that'll be the next episode. And that about does it. So, for an Alan Smithy podcast, I have been Matt.
And I have been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.
And where do we go from here, Dr. Mengers?
Well, I'm personally going to head a full-scale investigation into this incident. I'm supposed to discover who is responsible and to make absolutely certain that nothing like this could possibly happen again.
As an expert in tropical species, what danger is there in the possibility of the piranha reaching the ocean?
Oh, none at all. Most of them will have been destroyed by pollution at the end of the lake. Of course, if any of them did get through, there's no way they could survive the salt water.
There's nothing left to fear.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Best of an Alan Smithy Podcast. This is Genevieve Merchant. Good evening.